Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum and the organizer for tonight's meeting as part of the August Club platform, India Now. We welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. This evening's program is Bollywood Now, presented by Dr. Bulbul Tiwari, a fellow at Stanford University. Dr. Tiwari received her MA and PhD in South Asian Languages and Civilizations from the University of Chicago, focusing on Indian visual and performative cultural history. She is a media scholar, and she's written plays and directed plays, made films, and designed websites, and her works demonstrate her interest in myth, narratology, and technology, particularly in South Asia. Her digital multimedia dissertation, that's right, you can't find it in print, was completed at the University of Chicago and was the first one that was done there and only the third that had been done in the United States. She's currently revising it, and it will be available online next month, but not in your textbook. While at the University of Chicago, she taught courses in Indian film, in film style and interpretation, Indian intellectual history, Hinduism, and writing. She's worked in film industries in New York and Mumbai in various capacities, including producing and shooting her own documentary on Indian truck drivers, which was screened at festivals around the world and ended up on European television. Without further ado, Bollywood Now with Dr. Bulbul Tiwari. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you all for coming this Wednesday evening. It's a great pleasure to be here and to speak with you about some current affairs. I'm mostly, as Anne mentioned, a media scholar, and I do a lot of historical work, but I've tried to make this talk really about what's going on in South Asia and India today, so I hope it sort of relates to current affairs and what you recognize. I'm going to begin by showing you some images. You see in front of you sets of images, four, that somehow, I hope, seem to you to be of the same kind of thing. You see on your left, I believe, you'll see sort of these kind of effigy burning kind of protests, and in the bottom you'll see sort of mass protests, people holding signs, the Indian flag, of course, you'll see the New Delhi monument. And what's interesting here is that both of these, now these are extremely current affairs still going on. On one side, they're actually, the two images are on film protests to ban a film called Arakshan on the reservation system, which is positive discrimination for people from the lower castes, particularly going into universities. That film was released about 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago. And a lot of states have tried to ban it, or their people have protested its release, and the people, the Supreme Court recently overturned the ban, so the film will be released, but it drew a lot of sort of public fire. On the other side, you'll see that these are images of the still ongoing sort of anti-corruption protests, right? And Anna Hazare is, of course, still fasting. He's on his ninth day of his fast, protesting corruption in the Indian government. Now, both of these events really signal a fundamental shift in current Indian political and civil life and society, and the film industry is part of that. It's a very vibrant a part of public intellectual life and sort of civil society. And so a lot of my purpose today is to impress that upon you, but also to give you some background so that you can understand the history of this kind of industry, right? So a lot of people wonder, you know, why find out more about Bollywood? It's kind of regarded as a, I think, somewhat trashy, throwaway film industry. But the fact is that, you know, India is, just in terms of pure numbers, India has the world's biggest cinema industry. It produces nearly 1,000 films in more than 15 different languages every year, right? So it's incredibly large. Now, Bollywood is the name given to the Hindi language film industry centered in Mumbai, and it has an estimated 15 million viewers who go to the cinema every single day. So in terms of sheer volume, it's just phenomenal, right? You don't have that kind of appeal or that kind of mass participation in very many societies. Now, the Hindi language film industry does dominate. The second, of course, is the Tamil film language industry, and I won't be addressing that so much today. If you have questions, please ask me about that later. I tend to also speak quite fast, so if you have further follow-up questions, please feel free to write them down, and I'm happy to answer those as well. So I'm going to just begin a little bit by talking about the name Bollywood, right? And the name itself signals the fact that the film industry has is seen as, on some level, a rival or an kind of the other of Hollywood, right? And it is pretty much the only cinematic industry in the world today in terms of global popularity and appeal, audiences, and finances that can come anywhere close to rivaling Hollywood. So that's another reason why it's incredibly important to learn about it, to know about it, and to understand it. It's not just popular, of course, in South Asia. A lot of its audiences are found in the Middle East and East Africa. It's incredibly popular. Historically, it was very popular in the USSR and, you know, that whole kind of Eastern Bloc. Now the spread is pretty global. What you see now for the big budget Hindi language Bollywood films is that there's a simultaneous global release, right? So there's a release in Delhi, Bombay, London, New York, and LA at the same day. So it's very much a global industry, right? In some senses, this kind of Hollywood versus Bollywood fight is artificial because there is a lot of intermixing between the two. And the traffic goes both ways, as I'll kind of show you historically. It's been going both ways. Certainly, the Indian side of this conversation has been absorbing a lot of Hollywood from the kind of the moment it was born. So what I'll do for you in the rest of the talk is I'm just going to point out the major milestones over the last 120 years of Indian film history, sort of major shifts, so that you have a nice picture in your head and you feel confident about, you know, thinking more about this or talking more about this or following up on this, reading up more or watching more films. Again, you're welcome to ask me for specific recommendations from particular historical periods. All right. So let's go to the very beginning. Now, as I'm sure all of you know, the Lumiere brothers, of course, inaugurated their film in Paris, and pretty much the very same year, a couple of months later, it came to Bombay, right? Now called Mumbai. So film has been in the subcontinent from its very conception. Now, at the time, of course, the British were ruling the subcontinent, so it was very much kind of an elite activity. Only the kind of rich, cosmopolitan, mostly sort of westernized audience would go to these screenings. But they were incredibly popular from the very start. Indians actually coming behind the camera just a year later, right? You had Harishchandra Bavedkar, who made a short film on a wrestling match in Bombay, or another one about monkeys. So you had the beginning of film was nonfiction, documentary style. A lot of it was focusing on sort of exotic elements of the Indian landscape. So a lot of elephant processions, a lot of maharajas, and all that kind of stuff was what was the meat of all of these shorts. These shorts were exhibited, of course, using equipment from abroad. So all of this stuff came from Europe and America. And this kind of developed a big following. The early cinema is a really fascinating topic. There's a lot to be said there. I'm just kind of glossing over this just to give you an idea of the kind of complexity going on there. So silent film, fiction film, began under, of course, in the British Empire. And it was first, the first feature film was in 1913. It was not only India's first feature film, it was Asia's first feature film. And the man responsible for that was Phalke. Then he's called Dada Sahib because he's seen as the father of Indian cinema. He made a film called Raja Harishchandra, or King Harishchandra, and it was incredibly popular. And he it kind of inaugurated this movement of Indians making films and not just absorbing films from the rest of the country. Right, that's a picture of him there. Another very interesting thing about early cinema, silent cinema, under the empire is that it was always pretty much tied to politics and the independence movement. So it was always like a very, very kind of hot topic, right? So the British set up a censorship board immediately, and they wanted to monitor this new industry. They wanted to make sure that there wasn't too much sedition, there weren't these ideas circulating that would kind of harm the empire and so on. What the films did to work around these very strict censorship laws, right? This is the time when Mahatma Gandhi was a movement, it was really gathering steam and so on. So the British wouldn't even allow the spinning wheel to be shown on cinema. It was that strong a lamp down. So what the films did in response to this is that they turned to India's sort of distant mythological past, and they dipped into that, and they used that as kind of a disguise to talk about current affairs. So all of these stories were set in this mythic past, but they resonated with contemporary anti-imperialist themes. So the audience would kind of get it, right? But they couldn't be censored. Not only was early South Asian film nationalist, but it was also a strong supporter of the underdog, always, the poor man. And it opposed a lot of sort of social inequalities present in contemporary Indian society. They were very critical of a lot of social practices that were demeaning to certain pockets of people, such as, you know, the burning of widows, for example, or caste prejudice, etc. So from its very roots, it was sort of this kind of common man film. Ironically, though, because the audience at this point was still very elite, right? The other thing here is that South Asian cinema also projected a unified nation, right? There was no Hindu-Muslim division, no North-South division. And, of course, in the silent period, there was no language that was put forward as the national language. So you often had intertitles in more than one language. People would perform in whatever language was regional at that time. So it was really this kind of very interesting national cinema that was possible in silent cinema, right? And Bombay, at this very early period, emerged as the strongest center. It was followed later by other centers, but Bombay very early on was a center. So I hope you're beginning to see how some of these things continue still to be important today, right? Other unique features that we can think about that are still important now is that so South Asian film has always had these sort of strong local and national features, and they never really ventured further than Iran. So they stayed kind of in Asia, South Asia, Middle East area. But they also screened international silent films. So it was this very interesting kind of cosmopolitanism going around, which is, I think, a lot of interborrowing between styles. So it was very hard to say this is an Indian style, this is a non-Indian style, because from the very beginning there was a lot of, outright borrowing, if not stealing, of ideas going on both directions. So the silent feature films had distinct genres, right? The historical, mythological, social, etc. Once sound came, something really weird happened. So the division between Indian or South Asian films and other traditions became really stark, right? Because then language was introduced for the first time, and that made something Indian or non-Indian, you know, or South Asian. So the other thing it did was it introduced music as a very essential element of the cinematic experience. The first movie with sound that came out was in 1931 called Alam Ara, and it had over 24 songs. So songs have been part of the Indian cinematic experience from the very, very beginning. I can absolutely hypothesize why this is. If you're curious, I can talk to you about the history of the cinema in terms of which other performative modes it came from, but suffice it to say that the musical did not exist as a separate genre per se. It was just accepted as part of Indian cinema, you know, par for the course, sort of. So the first really major shift that I want to bring to your attention away from the silent cinema is what happened in 1947, right? The Indian nation was born, and that was a deeply, deeply profound moment for Indian cinema, South Asian cinema. The partition of the subcontinent into Pakistan, Bangladesh, India was very brutal for the film industry because you had a lot of Hindu and Muslim practitioners. So you had a lot of actors and producers who actually went underground. They didn't leave Bombay because most of the money was there and the industry was very strong there. They just kind of slipped under, changed their name. You know, a lot of famous actors changed their names into sort of more secular or Hindu-sounding names, etc. So that was it was a traumatic kind of moment. But you see this still there. There's this dream of this very secular, unified nation that's perfectly happy. Hindus and Muslims are always happy together. You always have like a token Muslim in these movies. And this is maintained, this kind of illusion is maintained, even though more recent Bollywood films have been extremely stridently patriotic, you know, very much for the state against anything else. This 1947 also marked the shift into the dominance of what was just before this, just one other genre. It became the social masala film began to dominate as a genre. It was kind of a catch-all, a rat bag, you know, it was like a hodgepodge of all kinds of different stuff going on, but it became the dominant kind of masala film. Now, these kind of films, they cater to the whole family. So different generations, they're meant to appeal to every human emotion, a bit of laughter, a bit of seriousness, a bit of this, a bit of that. It's called, you know, the name masala suggests it's kind of intermixing. It's also got, obviously, the song and the dance and the violence, you know, so it's really meant to be this entire complete package. And this became pretty much the most successful formula going around. And so to this day, this formula is the one that kind of dominates, right? The other kind of feature that was born in the 1940s, sort of 40s, the 40s, 50s classic, what's called the classical cinema or the golden age, is the birth of the celebrity culture, which is still extremely strong in India today. There's a sort of a almost rabid following for certain actors, and they can make or break a film. And each so-called star often ends up playing the same role in all of their movies. So movies are basically just trappings for this one particular actor or actress. So you see here images in the film from the 40s, very famous couple, actually, who are having a sort of a torrid affair off-screen, or so the tabloids reported, and they created this mass following. On the other, you know, all the way up to now, where you have a man like Shah Rukh Khan, who sort of dominates a lot of the magazines, but of course the industry itself. And his success is phenomenal. He's been dominating the industry for over 25 years at this point. And he still looks like that. It's great. So the 40s also gave birth to this kind of idea that cinema was sort of a popular mass media, right? It had enormous appeal across the classes, but in particular the lower classes, and it was seen as catering to that. So a lot of critics, internal critics as well as external critics, called it sentimental and escapist, like just sort of this candy floss, really. And this actually led to the birth of an actual film movement. So in 1955, Indian cinema split into art and mainstream, right? And this is marked by the release of a very famous film, which I'm sure all of you know, the Pathar Panchali, part of the Apu trilogy by Satyajit Ray. And this kind of split survived for almost, you know, it's still present, this shift into art cinema and mainstream cinema, catering for two different tastes. So this is in the 50s. This is actually not in Bombay, right? This is from a different city altogether, a different region, and it Calcutta was home to these innovative, very intellectual filmmakers. You see a picture here of Hrithik Ghatak, and then Mrinal Sen, and finally Satyajit Ray. So these three sort of heavyweight intellectual, they look really serious, right? All their movies were about death and decay, abuse of women, poverty, tragedy, etc. It's a very sort of heavy, weighty, the partition. It was just heavy stuff. So now while these guys were extremely regional in the sense that their films were actually made in Bangla, right? They didn't even make it in, Satyajit Ray made a couple of movies in Hindi, but it was very, very Bangla kind of oriented. They were conversing with the Italian neorealist movement or the French auteur theorists, you know, or the Japanese filmmakers. So they're very global in kind of their appeal to the sort of high art, right? And they made no excuses or bones about it. Now, art film in India was only is only really popular amongst the urban educated elites and international viewers. So there's kind of weird division that happens that still continues today in another form. So the second major shift, I'm going to just skip right ahead, is in 1991. Was another major moment where the industry completely changed shape, and it began with the deliberalization of the Indian economy and mass media. So this is in 1991, and what this did was this affected the way films were financed, and it also affected the kind of technology that could come into India, but it also affected, of course, audience and viewerships, because suddenly India was exposed to all kinds of international channels and media and products that it wasn't before. So Indian tastes began to change, right? What this meant for the Indian film industry was there was like this globalization, first of all, of financial markets and audiences. The Hindi Hindi popular film became very interested in the diasporic hero, right? This also matched current affairs of the time. So the 80s and 90s, there was like migration starting actually in the 70s into places like the UK and the US, and their kids were born and growing up, and those kids wanted to consume Indian movies. And so a lot of these movies were made for those young people. How did this affect the way the films looked? So in terms of the form, you could see a very definite shift in terms of the production values. They became very much, much slicker, really more expensive looking, very lavish sets, beautifully finished, great costuming. A lot of films are shot in exotic locations like Australia, Malaysia, Switzerland, you know, becoming really, really international. In terms of content, the heroes and the heroines of these films all dress in Western clothes, make no apologies about it. It's not seen as something different. They live outside India often, right? A lot of stories are about coming home or about leaving home. So it's about the sort of diasporic identity, and that kind of motivates the plot. However, interestingly, or perhaps, you know, not that interestingly or surprisingly, one of the key features is that even though there is this kind of gloss or costuming of Western affect, right, there is still this assertion of Indian identity, which in all of these films comes down to family values, right? However the film defines it, it is this sort of very traditional Indian family, respecting your elders, the girls don't sleep with the boys before marriage, that kind of stuff. Like, it just continues, that continues on. So the diasporic Indian film also had other kind of reverberations, so to speak, right? So the art cinema tradition I told you about then is inherited by Indian filmmakers who are part of the diaspora, who want to make these more serious films, right? So directors like Deepa Mehta, right? You see here her film Fire, about sort of lesbian desire, right? She continued to make movies that are provocative, often banned in India, but often to do with women's rights and other kinds of sexual identity and so on. Meera Nair, the other one you see, who also made kind of films that challenge all of these hush-hush things, you know, like incest in a family or sexual abuse, et cetera, or racism, you know, all of those things. So these are the kind of inheritors of the art tradition. So they start making these more serious films. The other kind of effect of the diaspora mingling into the Indian film industry is that you suddenly have these really edgy, funny movies made by second-generation Indians from nations like the UK, Britain, UK and Britain are the same, United States, Britain, and Australia. So they talk about what it is to grow up as a person of color in a country that is not the country of your parents. So they made some actually phenomenal movies. I mean, if you've ever seen East is East, I think it's hilarious. I would recommend it. Bend It Like Beckham, of course, is another one that was quite famous. Indian cinematic talent also began to travel at this point, right? So not only do you have films shown all over the planet, you also see this kind of movement of actors and directors. So Aishwarya Rai, who was a model and transitioned into acting, is one such star, right? You see her there in Pink Panther 2, Bride and Prejudice. And then directors like Shekhar Kapoor, who were responsible for the Elizabeth franchise, you see them also moving across. So you have this kind of interchange going on there. Now, the kind of culmination of this second major shift that I've outlined for you is Slumdog Millionaire, which I'm sure all of you have seen or definitely heard about. So it won the Oscars in 2009, and this kind of beautifully made, beautifully packaged. I don't think it's beautifully made personally. It's beautifully packaged, kind of exotic poverty kind of world, and that is kind of the, I think, the height of this achievement of this global, this second phase of global Indian cinema. The third major shift, and this is the last major shift I'm going to talk about, is what we're currently seeing now, which I have just called the PVR Bollywood. PVR is an acronym for India's most successful theater chain, and they currently have hundreds of multiplex cinemas all over India in malls, right? And so they're indicative of what I talk of, this kind of rise of the Indian middle class. A lot of wealthy people who want to spend money, love going to malls, young kids, and they love going to the PVR cinemas. Because before you had these cinemas, going to the cinema was seen as a lower class kind of activity. The halls were dingy. They were dirty. Women didn't feel safe there. They were looked upon, as dens of sin. So this is no longer the case. All of these PVR cinemas are air conditioned and plush seats, so this is the latest kind of phase, or what you've seen is this kind of full circle effect, where Indian cinema kind of, from having a very national, if you begin with the first phase, it's kind of nationalist existence as representing the Indian nation. It then went global. It's now come home, but it's learned a lot in its travels, right? So you have this mixture of constant mixture of East and West in terms of ideas, film styles, characters, the way they dress, etc. The art and mainstream divide no longer makes sense, because a lot of movies just collapse this division overtly. I would argue with the commercial side winning, because often these films end up being quite preserving the status quo and being quite mainstream. But anyway, the intention is that they do ostensibly talk about serious issues. These are all movies that are made for largely a domestic audience, but of course international as well. But they have a huge new audience in this multiplex middle-class cinema. And this is the rise of the same civil society that is responding to Anna Hazare's protest, right, the anti-corruption. So it's this new India that is being catered to. All of these films tend to be extremely self-aware, right? They're very meta films. They talk about their cinematic ancestors. They reference, they're very aware of their own artifice. They reference Indian film history. They talk about that all the time. These are just three examples here that you see of that. The other thing is also the dominance of this young, urban, male-driven narratives, which is unique to India, I think, because if Hollywood is often catering to either, to teenagers, right, or children, or middle-class women. Those are the two sort of demographics that make money for Hollywood. For Bollywood now, the demographic, the key demographic, is young, urban, male-driven narratives, often Western-educated males, engineers, sort of the professionals, right? And they're the ones being appealed to in all of these different films. So I've just given some examples here of those three films. So I have about 15 minutes, and I'm going to use that time to just give you an example of this, just to wrap up the whole talk, by showing you some clips. And I'm actually going to show you a clip from a movie, The Three Idiots, that was referenced right there, from 2009. Let me just get a sip of water. So this is a song from this movie. Three Idiots was incredibly popular. It was it's a multiplex movie, right? But it's very mainstream, Hindi language, and it was a global hit, but it was also a domestic hit, which was what it was most important about it. And Three Idiots is about these young college kids who really who are sick and tired of the Indian system churning out machines, and they want to be individuals, right? That's the narrative, right? Which, again, should resonate with what's going on in India now in terms of the anti-corruption protests. It's about not being happy with the status quo and challenging the status quo. And so these three idiots kind of go through engineering college, and they learn to sort of challenge that paradigm. Now, it's still, because it's a Bollywood movie, it still has the usual trappings of song and dance and romance. And the clip I'm going to show you now is actually a song from that movie. So it's the only love song in that movie, but it's done in an extremely sort of cute way. And I'm just going to talk about, I'm going to pause it and talk a little bit over it. It doesn't have subtitles because it's from YouTube. No, so the lyrics are nonsensical. It's just about sort of, you know, love and enjoying life and falling in love. Now the first set here is the hero and the heroine. Now she's in pink and he's in cream. They meet at an Indian wedding, which is sort of a classic place to meet a future mate, right? And they reference that by stepping back into this fake, old-looking sort of black and white. You know, this is what you do in the movies. This is how you fall in love. And they kind of seem to understand that this is what's going on, and this kind of magic happens, and this magic is possible. But this magic is partly the creation of cinema itself. Okay. Now, the clip I want to show you to go along with this is actually from. Oh dear, I didn't search for it. Is from a movie from the second shift. So if you go back just one, if you just go back one phase, you get this major blockbuster film from the 1990s called Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham, which was just this enormously, it was one of the most expensive films ever made for its time. And it was also, now, so it featured basically these couples falling in love at Indian weddings, right? So this is being referenced in Three Idiots 10 years later, right? So you see the costume is almost exactly the same. The actress is actually the same because she's sort of making fun of herself almost. Now, this is more classically Bollywood in the sense that it's not meta at all. It's loving the fact that it's all glitzy and glamorous and everything is mass coordinated. It's absolutely not making fun of itself in any sense. Now, this is from, as I said, the second major shift, the paradigm shift that I talked about. And this is actually set in a family that has its business in the UK. So it's this extremely rich, affluent family based in the UK, and they have these extremely ostentatious weddings, right? Which is something that is reflective of, fact for many diasporic Indians. Now, as I said, the filmmaking here is not at all self-aware or meta. It's not making fun of itself or ironic. It's very full frontal. It's about pure display of beautiful men, beautiful women wearing these kind of costumes and, you know, falling in love, really falling in love and not thinking about it critically at all. Right? So let's just go back to our original clip now. Where you have the sort of more ironic mode from recent Indian cinema, and think about, so this, it continues with her seeing this guy. She starts seeing him everywhere. He's suddenly on her TV, right? So this is again referencing the omnipresence of satellite television in India. In all these different genres, right? He's a, both a, he's a spiritual guru, he's playing Hanuman, he's playing the weatherman, he's just omnipresent. In a way, so is media. So this movie is really smart about that, about the kind of media moment it's in. It then shifts into this reference into classical Bollywood cinema with this rain scene. Now this rain scene is taken from 40s cinema, from one of the most famous couples ever. Has this expired? I'm sorry, there might be some ads. So this is a reference to classic cinema from the 40s. I said Raj Kapoor and Nargis were so this famous couple, and they made these beautiful, beautiful films that are seen as sort of the pinnacle of romance in the golden period of Indian cinema. And that's what's being referenced at that moment in that song. And I'll just show it to you once the ad is over. Right, so this is from Shri Char Sobis, an endearing little movie, very much about, you know, poor boy falling in love with a rich girl. These songs are still incredibly popular. I mean, many people know them by heart, you know. And this kind of, this is the first wet sari film of all time, actually. And but it's just so beautiful and chaste that it's something altogether different, right? And it's become sort of emblematic of romance. It's very sweet and very endearing. So again, the shooting style here is absolutely not meta, right? It's not self-referential, but it's also it's very tender. It's not at all glamorous or big. It's not about big sets. It's not about display. It's not about wowing you with elements. It's really about the close-up on these faces. It's about the sentiment, and it's really about the lyrics. So it's another moment in Indian cinema that I talked about. So this is the first kind of. This is the national cinema I'm talking about. So this is now being referenced as a unique moment that contemporary films talk about. So I hope that this kind of illustration made sense to you. Those were just some examples, and these are the song continues to reference a third film from the same era, which you can look up if you're interested. It's also quite beautiful. It's very similar of the same kind of thing. So the questions, hopefully, I think you're asking yourself are, when I've outlined for you these three major shifts, you want to ask yourself, how deep or profound are these changes? You know, well, for one, I've made them up a little bit for this talk, but you know, most of them are sort of commonly accepted now. But you want to ask yourself, how profound are these shifts? Like, are the movies all that different? Is that an important question? Why does it matter? I mean, when we're thinking about change, Bollywood still remains Bollywood. Bollywood, by definition, means popular cinema, which means there will always be something that's not Bollywood. Like, there'll always be a seedy underbelly, so to speak, right? Almost by that name. So those are just some questions that might appeal to you. I wanted to return to my opening slide just to make you think back to the fact that, as I pointed out to you, this is a remarkable moment in India now, and in Bollywood now too, because of the growth of this new civil society, the Indian middle class gaining more and more power and wanting representation, wanting things like its own cinema, right? And that's kind of like how I thought it would be a nice way to wrap up and frame this talk because of what's going on currently. So with that, I think I'll just end those and take your questions. So.
Thank you. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to a talk on Bollywood Now by Stanford University fellow Bulbul Tiwari. We have questions, so let's begin. Shall I ask? Okay. Relating to what you were actually just talking about a bit, could you speak a bit more about the gendering of Bollywood film consumption over time? You spoke of women not feeling safe or comfortable earlier attending films. Are women now a major demographic, or is it still, that is attendance, I guess, very male-driven?
Great. Thank you for that question. So in terms of the demographic, the question's absolutely right. That at the very early days, silent cinema, of course, it was an elite activity by and large. So you often had, you know, women were escorted in public as they always were. So women were seen, but in the very early days, there was this big stigma against women acting in films because to display yourself that publicly was seen as humiliating. So the first actors on the silent screen are all in drag or they're eunuchs. You didn't have a woman actually acting for quite a while, a couple of years until the industry became less disreputable, but it still has that kind of taint to it. In terms of shifting into the 50s, 60s, 70s, it's been a male dom. I mean, India is, of course, a stridently patriarchal society. I mean, many places in the world are, but India is quite unabashedly so, I would say, so that it makes no apology. So beyond just that, I think in terms of audiences, the appeal has always been for sort of male-driven narratives. And the 70s was kind of a high point of that. You had a lot of angry young men film, they're called. It's about young migrant workers and very violent, kind of aggressive films. I think that has softened a little over time. So the PVR movement that I talked about, even though it's still dominated, male-dominated, you do have a smaller cut of films made for women, audience members. The kind of Jane Austen-y type appeal, so sort of romantic. They're not particularly socially, they're not like Thelma and Louise style angry films, but they're still, you know, they're very conventional, I guess is the word I'm looking for. But they're much, much in the minority. So I think that in terms of the gender discrimination, it still continues, although it's less so, as I said, partly because the theaters are so much nicer and better. And if you go in a group, like a group of girls going to the cinema, it's not at all, nobody blinks an eye. Whereas that would not have been possible in sort of the older India in the 90s, so to speak. You would, yeah.
Are the theaters in the malls still available to or accessible to the lower classes?
They can't afford it. I mean, if they can pay for the ticket, of course, no one's going to turn them away. But tickets sale are often so expensive that no one's going to go there. They would rather go to their local older cinema because the ticket prices there are one-tenth the price, right? So just by hiking the prices up, they exclude poor people.
And a technical question, just clarify what you mean by your use of meta movie and so on.
Okay, so by meta, I'm talking about being self-aware in a very loose kind of way. It's nothing particularly technical about it, but just a movie being aware of being a movie, right? The artifice of movie making itself. Like you saw in that one song, it would shift into a different filter and a different screen from color into black and white. So it's aware of the artifice of that. And it kind of transitions into that. So it's meta in the way that it's aware of being a film. The story itself is.
discuss how the film industry, and you've referred to this a bit, is handling partition during the Cold War and the continuing tensions with Pakistan and Kashmir. Does the film industry address all those tensions at all?
So that's a great question. So in terms of the partition of the subcontinent is a different issue from what's been happening in the subcontinent with sectarian violence later. So the partition was handled, was largely ignored by mainstream Bollywood. It was really a topic for art cinema, right? The serious cinema I talked about that made these really overwhelming, the very powerful but very weepy films about the tragedy of partition, not just in Pakistan, India, but also Bangladesh, India, because the state of Bengal was partitioned, where all of these filmmakers came from. So it was a big topic there. As I said, ignored by mainstream cinema. What you have seen since the late 80s into the 90s is this kind of growth of sectarian violence in India, the Hindu and Muslim riots, and that has been discussed quite a bit in mainstream cinema, but very much from the point of view of the Indian state. So the film always takes the side of the Indian state. So there are terrorists and there are us. The terrorists are bad people, we're good people. You never, ever have movies that are sympathetic to the terrorists. There was one film that was vaguely sympathetic to a terrorist called Dil Se by a very popular director, and it bombed in the box office. So most... If you're talking about Bollywood, by which it's like mainstream Hindi language popular cinema, it is really taking the position of the Indian state and talking about Hindu-Muslim relations there. Since 9/11, of course, there's been another major shift in topics that's also fed back into movies. So like My Name is Khan that came out last year, it talks a lot about racial profiling since 9/11. A lot other movies have talked about the threat of terrorists. There have been very good movies made about the bombings in Bombay and other parts of the country. So it's not a topic avoided at all now, unlike partition. It's actually something that's discussed, but again, from a conventional state perspective by and large.
Back to the industry production values again. This questioner asks if Bollywood's films traditionally have a reputation for being longer than average. Yes, I guess. Now, with the advent of the PVR, Global Hollywood Cineplexes and so on, films are being made shorter in length. What's gained, what's lost in terms of integrity, quality, names, and so on?
Okay, great. So the length of film that we have is somewhat arbitrary. At least in the silent era, a lot of the film's length was decided by how many reels you had and how much power the projectionist had to switch that, and that's no longer a valid concern. So the two-hour window, which is what's prevalent in the West, is on some level seen as arbitrary, because in India, the three-hour thing is a standard fare. But as I said, the three-hour masala movie is seen as being, it's kind of, you know, it's meant to appeal to everybody, and that takes some time. Also, the way that the narrative is constructed, it's far more cyclical. It's less linear. And Indian audience behavior is also very different. People tend to sing along with songs. People tend to go to sleep. People tend to go away and come back. People take a break and have some chai. You know, that kind of stuff has been factored into the three-hour length. So the PVR cinema, because it's in this multiplex, more Western mall kind of culture, is shortening its length also because it wants to appeal to the Western audience in terms of not always having an intermission. But even they do, so they're 2.5, right? So the one thing that seems to be cut from these movies is the songs, actually, unfortunately. So films like Three Idiots really only has 2 songs, whereas a full-on Bollywood movie would have 8 songs or something like that. So the thing that's lost are songs. You're also having, you're seeing the loss of these kind of, thing like side characters. You'd always have like some comedic guy or some, the buffoon or the fool kind of, or you have a subplot. Those things are being taken away. So the story is becoming tighter and the narrative is becoming more kind of focused, which I guess you could say is a good thing, or you could see it as it's just becoming conventional and more westernized. So it depends on your perspective. You think it's a loss or a gain. It really depends on whether you think you're preserving or you're losing some kind of Indian essential character or not.
What do people think? Do they think they're losing? Is there commentary from critics, for example, about what's being gained or lost?
I haven't seen any commentary about that, no.
Someone had asked, are films being made without music or dancing? And so that's what's happening. Is that
so?
What about the dance?
Films without music, so the art cinema of India, right? Satyajit Ray and so on, they didn't have music. They never had musical numbers unless it was diegetic, i.e. part of the story, right? So Satyajit Ray made a movie about, he made a movie about a landlord who loved music. And so the music was part of the plot. And so you had a musical number because there was actually an actor there who had an instrument singing. Whereas art films never had song and dance numbers. So that was seen as one of the features of an art film versus a Bollywood film, was that music thing. Now that you're getting into movies that are more serious, the musical number is just changing. Whereas in sort of a mainstream Indian film, the musical number is this occasion for pure fantasy and play, where you switch location in geography, your mind switches, costume changes happen, like it's completely illogical. That is kind of, in some sense, being toyed with. So PVR cinema movies have a musical number, maybe only one or two, but those musical moments are an occasion for something else, like they're an occasion for a particular aesthetic style to come out, or they kind of start referencing a particular movie or a particular book, and they play with that more. So it's more artistically coherent, right?
And I have a couple of specific questions about specific people or instances. The first one I can answer, I think it's referring to our Lumiere Theater here in San Francisco, which is named after Lumiere.
The brothers, yeah.
Yeah, the brothers. Here's the question. Was the director Meera Nair, who made films in the USA, respected in India?
She's still making films. Is she respected in India? That's a very broad question. I think Monsoon Wedding was absolutely very popular with this kind of middle-class crowd. A film like Monsoon Wedding got a lot of traction, but another, like Mississippi Masala, was like, eh. So it depends on the film. As a filmmaker, I wouldn't say she's not respected, but she's certainly not seen as, wow, the second coming or something. I don't think she's seen as that anywhere, but, some of her films are very popular.
Is she seen as a Bollywood person?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No. She's part of, as I said, the art house, more diasporic cinema thing.
Are there filmmakers who are not Bollywood people who are respected?
So two directors that I personally respect a lot. So Anurag Kashyap is a very talented director. Vishal Bhardwaj is a very respected director as well. They both make movies in Hindi. Hindi language, which are neither Bollywood nor art. They're sort of this part of this third phase, they're kind of PVR in appeal, but they're very respected. Not all Bollywood directors are respected either. This kind of respect for a director, or looking at the director as an auteur, is not really part of the way Indians think about films. As I said, the star, the celebrity, dominates the film. First, secondly, the producer is the second person mentioned. The director is really regarded as much lower down the totem pole in terms of the film as a craft, right? This idea of the director being the most important person of a film, of course, I'm sure all of you know, is itself an artifice, is the result of the the auteur theory being. It's because of 60s. New wave cinema, etc. It's a movement that began in the 60s in the West as well. So it's part of a cinematic theory and approach. And that's not the case, by and large, with the public. They don't often know who the director is or care.
Yeah,
they don't care.
Let's see. Do our publics differ?
A couple of other specific questions. Your familiarity with the role of Indian Jews in the formation of Bollywood, and if you can mention any Indian Jewish actresses, actors in Bollywood films.
I know absolutely nothing about that, actually, so I'm sorry.
That's a good question to illuminate the speaker. And what did Indians think of Bend It Like Beckham?
The movie had most of its appeal, I think, with the diasporic audiences. I don't know of that many Indians in India who have watched it, frankly. It's been mostly second-generation Indians and stuff, you know. It's very much a particular movie about, you know, being a person of color in a white society, so.
And that's not an interesting...
Not with the mass Indian audience, no. Yeah.
And just one more, kind of to wrap it up. It remind us again why music was introduced into films in the first place.
Sure.
And that helps us figure out why it's being cut out.
Sure. So in terms of thinking about where cinema came from, and, you know, there are a lot of theories circulating of where cinema came from in the West or, say, in places like even America, you know, and one of the major forms that led to it, people think about it as theater, you know, just straight up theater, of course, led to it. But in India, you didn't have the dominance of this kind of straightforward theater with sort of pure dialogue, full frontal kind of exchange. What you had were a long history of more traditional pre-modern forms where song and dance was very seamlessly part of the action, right? So you're thinking about folk arts and classical arts where there's constant live musical accompaniment to the action on stage. This kind of Western-style cinema house did come to India. It came mostly with the British Empire, and Shakespeare, of course, had a huge influence on early Indian theater, it led to a lot of Indian writing plays, but this was a very much a modern form, a colonial form. But if you think of pre-modern, pre-colonial forms, they all have music, right? And so music is seen as part of storytelling and part of entertainment. And so it just seemed natural to have it on screen. I think that's the...
And it's part of the psyche of the people.
Right. Well, if one can essentialize the psyche, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, our warmest thanks to Dr. Bobul Tiwari. Thank you so much. Very illuminating. And thanks to you all, our audience today, and our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you. Really appreciate it. I learned.